From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The war on terror is, at its heart, a shadow war, a war of rooting out terrorists where they hide, of thwarting attacks before they happen. And the most important weapons in this war are intelligence and information that often rest only in the minds of terror suspects around the world. Getting to those suspects, getting that information, and getting it on time could save American lives. Hundreds, maybe thousands of terror suspects have been captured so far in the war on terror. They're being held in Guantanamo, in Afghanistan, perhaps on ships at sea. But what happens to them once they are in custody? How far should interrogators go to get critical information? Mark Bowden wanted to know in a new round of reporting. The Black Hawk Down author takes us to the darkest front in the war on terror, into the interrogation rooms and undisclosed locations where American agents and their allies are squeezing for information with questions, coercion, and maybe torture. The dark art of interrogation presents a deep political dilemma and a morally clouded means to fighting terrorism. There was a before 9/11 and after 9/11, said one counterterrorism agent last year. And after 9/11, the gloves came off. But how far should interrogators go? Should the U.S. use coercion and torture when questioning international terror suspects? Where do you draw the line between interrogation and torture in the war on terror? If information gathered in interrogation rooms in Guantanamo or Pakistan or Diego Garcia can save American lives, do you care how it was extracted? Do you even want to know? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Wilmington, Delaware, is Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down. His latest article, The Dark Art of Interrogation, is a sweeping survey of techniques of persuasion and coercion and their place in the war on terror. It appears in the October issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Good evening and welcome, Mark Bowden.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you with us, Mark Bowden. It's quite a survey that you give us here, and there's a lot in this article that I really knew nothing about. But you raise the curtain and remind us of how important these issues are by describing the arrest and the challenge of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Could you take us back to that, Mark Bowden, describe what happened there and remind us how it shows what U.S. agents are up against once they get a terrorist into their hands?
Well, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is the most significant al-Qaeda leader that the United States has managed to find and take into custody. And he was tracked down to a house in Rawalpindi, which is a city in Pakistan, just adjacent to Islamabad. He was taken into custody. He was questioned for about 3 days by the Pakistani secret police. And then he was turned over to the United States and flown to what they call Hotel California, which is a sort of euphemism for the various undisclosed locations where the United States government is holding some of these really top-level terrorist captives.
And when a man like this shows up at Hotel California, wherever and whatever exactly that is, I mean, this is the guy who reputedly was the architect of two attacks on the World Trade Center, the failed one in 93, the terribly successful one in 2001, believed to be behind the bombings of attacks on U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, the bombing of the USS Cole, the slaughter of Daniel Pearl. But this is no babe in the woods by any stretch. And as you write, once U.S. authorities have him, he's not imagining he's ever going to get out. He's very committed to his cause. The challenge of getting someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to start talking sounds like a very, very tall one.
It does, and yet we read reports in subsequent months that tell us that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has provided useful information for American officials to capture other al-Qaeda leaders, to head off planned al-Qaeda attacks. Whether or not these reports are true remains to be seen. But if they are true, it means that someone like Sheikh Mohammed, who is the most dedicated and intelligent of al-Qaeda operatives in captivity, is somehow being made to talk.
Mark Bowden, at this point, what do we know about the numbers and about where terror suspect captives are? How many? Where are they being held?
Well, Kofor Black, who is the U.S. ambassador for counterterrorism in the State Department, estimated there were 3,000 people in custody in the war on terror. And most of those captives are being held in Guantanamo Bay at Camp X-Ray. But most of those people are foot soldiers who were captured in the war in Afghanistan, who were fighting for the Taliban or for Al-Qaeda. The people I'm writing about, for the most part, are the dozen or so really top-level Al-Qaeda figures who have been captured in Pakistan primarily, but in some other places around the world, mm-hmm. who are believed to be really high-level figures who have an understanding of how Al-Qaeda works, what Al-Qaeda's plans are, and in what might be happening in the future.
At a certain point, you write, Mark, that things may progress into the realm which is kind of playfully put, described as smacky face, but there's nothing playful about it once it comes. That is potentially physical violence. But there's an awful lot of terrain between an arrest and that. The whole terrain of interrogation is a very subtle one in many ways, but there's a lot about that that's no fun at all. From your reporting, what is the likely environment into which a captive like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is put, is left to make him more open to sharing what he knows?
Well, I think the most simplistic view that people have is that if you want to make someone talk, you torture them. You pull out their fingernails or, hold them over a flame or something mm-hmm. like that. And it turns out that these sort of brutal tactics, which have been used and continue to be used in third world countries around the globe, are not the most effective way to get people to talk. The United States had, up until about 1972 or 1973, a fairly sophisticated program for, involving behavioral science, involving the experience of military interrogators and intelligence interrogators over many years, that had been honed to a fairly sophisticated kind of dark academic pursuit, which is how do you make somebody tell you something that they don't want to tell you.
And this was coming out of World War II and the deep of the Cold War.
That's right. It's mm-hmm. out of World War II and the Cold War. And there was a big burst of, behavioral science experimentation in the 50s and 60s, which led, frankly, to the drug revolution and the whole hippie phenomenon in the late 1960s. But it was also on the dark side of that. These were projects that were carefully monitored, in some cases funded, by the CIA.
They were looking at LSD and all the rest of it, mind-altering drugs that might open up Cold War adversaries.
Exactly, because it turns out that the best way to get people to talk is not to subject them to pain, but to keep them disoriented, to keep them off balance, to keep them uncomfortable, to keep them in fear of being tortured. But in that state, a person becomes very vulnerable and suggestive, and that's when they're most likely to tell you what you want to know.
You write that ultimately the drugs and the idea of truth serum are a lot less effective than just the manipulation of a prisoner's environment. What kind of elements go into putting a prisoner deeply off balance? Describe the kind of routine that a prisoner might face.
Well, someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's the most significant of the Al-Qaeda figures that we have in custody, would probably be held in a very small cell where he wouldn't be able to completely relax. He wouldn't be able to stand or sit or stretch out in any comfortable way. He would be kept awake, probably cold, probably hungry. He would be in a place where the light was shining 24 hours a day, where loud music was blaring. He would lose sense of any kind of the normal rhythms of that a human being lives by, and gradually would become sort of disconnected from reality in that way. All human beings are really creatures of habit. We thrive on rhythm and routine. And when you lock a person in a very uncomfortable, sensory deprived environment where they have no sense of what day it is or what time of day it is or anything, you know, any kind of normal reference point, they sort of lose touch with reality.
And then into that circumstance comes the interrogator. And you write in some amazing detail, Mark Bowden, about what an art, not really a science, but what an art this is. What kind of interrogation routine might these prisoners be facing? And what makes an effective or an ineffective interrogator interrogation?
It's a subtle art, and I call it an art rather than a science, because there is no formula that will make somebody talk. It's more a matter of a skillful individual, an interrogator, who is capable of reading the person that he's questioning. And, you know, a person like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed might be subjected to a long interrogation session involving three or four different questioners taking place, you know, taking sort of turns questioning him over a long period of time. Then he might be taken away to his cell or whatever you want to call it, and then hauled back out a couple hours later for a 5 or 10 minute questioning session, and then being led back to his cell and kept there for 5 days and then being held out. The big thing is to keep the prisoner so off balance that no routine develops. Within those interrogation sessions, the key is to elicit information that can be checked out immediately, so that the questioner is backed up by a team that can follow up on everything that the prisoner says.
To give the interrogators this feeling of omniscience, so the prisoner feels as though he's facing people who know an awful lot, and if he gives them something that's false, they magically know that very quickly.
Right. And, you know, someone like Sheikh Mohammed, say, for instance, he tried to tell a lie, or he tried to spin a story that would send American investigators off on the wrong track. If you have a skillful team of investigators backing up the interrogator, within that interrogation session, they might be able to come back and report to the interrogator, either through a radio in his ear or a little session with him out in the hall, that these things that he's told you are true, these things that he's told you are false. And so the prisoner, who is immediately confronted by the interrogator with the knowledge that what you've just told me is a lie, and I know it's a lie, mm-hmm. that's something that really unsettles someone and makes them think that this interrogator is like omniscient, you know, that he seems to know everything.
Mark Bowden, we're going to look at this in a lot more detail, but at the end of it all, you remind us how enormous the stakes can be here, how many lives can be on the line in these interrogations, and you come to the conclusion that there may well be circumstances in which a move from psychological to physical, at least coercion, if not torture, and maybe torture, may be justified. But is that part of the program currently with the American treatment of these prisoners?
I don't think that American officials are torturing prisoners, but I do think that they are holding over the heads of these prisoners the threat of being turned over to countries where brutal forms of torture are practiced. And I also think it's important that that threat be real.
Are you saying that the United States does not torture?
Well, it depends on your definition of torture, to fall into a sort of a Bill Clinton-esque response. The standard definitions of torture in all of the international agreements are all preceded by the adjective severe. And so I think that what the United States is doing is playing upon that definition of torture. Is coercion torture? Is a form of pressuring someone that leaves no permanent damage, that doesn't scar anyone, that doesn't involve applying actual pain? Is that torture? The United States doesn't think so.
Mark Bowden, hold the thought right there. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about coercion, torture, and the dark art of interrogation, how the war on terror is being fought in U.S. holding cells around the world. Should American forces cross that line to torture, and in what circumstances? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at coercion, torture, and the dark art of interrogation, how the war on terror is being fought or not fought in U.S. holding cells around the world. You can join the conversation. Do you assume that prisoners of the U.S. government in the war on terror are now being tortured or not? What's the line between heavy interrogation and torture? Should American forces cross that line? And did 9/11 change your mind about torture in the face of terrorism, of extreme danger, or not? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest, the illustrious journalist and writer Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down, and in the October issue of the Atlantic Monthly, The Dark Art of Interrogation. Let's take a call right now. Joe's calling in from Wilson, North Carolina. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hey, sir. How you doing?
Just great. Thanks.
Good. Sorry, I'm in my cell phone here, but I was listening to the show, and I'm glad you took my call, and I appreciate you being on the air here.
It's good to have you. What's on your mind, Joe?
Well, I'm a pilot in the Marine Corps, and I can tell you everything that Mark has been telling you is absolutely true. In the training that we've had, the most effective interrogators are by far the guys that either befriend you or conduct some type of psychological interrogation, not the torturous type of interrogation that everybody thinks that us and everybody else around the world does. The top countries in the world, 100% guaranteed, know that by torture, everybody has a breaking point, and once you get to that breaking point, you're going to say anything to that interrogator just to get them off your case. And the harder ones and the smarter ones are the guys that, you know, whether it's playing music, annoying music for 10 days straight or whatever it may be, that's the kinds of things that can break a person down more so than beating them and conducting some type of physical beatings. And,
so, Joe, you're saying that it's just not effective to use physical torture in interrogation?
Not at all. And you know, like you said, brought up in the show, the threat or hanging over your head of handing over these guys to other countries is probably psychologically, these guys know if they go back home, they're probably in for. And their countries don't respect or have the same values as our folks do, and I can say probably 100% that our people are not torturing these guys, and I can say that with 100% satisfaction.
Joe, thanks for your call, and particularly from your vantage point, we appreciate your calling in. Mark Bowden, there's a Marine saying torture's not going on. Psychological interrogation and pressure is much more effective. If Americans could put their noses right up to the glass and watch what is going on, do you think they would agree with him?
I think so. I think the overwhelming majority of Americans would agree that the policies, that the practices, certainly the official ones, are what we would hope we would be doing. There are people who feel that anybody who's in custody needs to be treated with a great deal of respect or needs to be treated under the stipulations of the Geneva Accords. And I think people like that might be upset about the way that some of these prisoners are being treated. But, I think they would be in a minority at the present time.
Well, we want to look straight at this. We don't want to pretty it up either. I mean, you describe all kinds of pressure that is certainly hair-raising, even if it's not pulling out fingernails. Our caller said there that when you get to the point of physical violence or extreme physical violence anyway, in some sense, the interrogator has lost the battle. Take us into that, Mark Bowden.
It's true. In fact, the CIA and other, militaries around the world have, for centuries have dealt with interrogation and, have studied it. There have been all kinds of organized sort of behavioral, psychological studies of what works and what doesn't work. And it turns out that the threat of pain is far more frightening than pain itself, that most people manage to cope with pain a whole lot better than they think they can. And, you know, I would hate to think of the experiments that led to that finding. But, you know, I think that, you know, that's one of the things that guides our procedure. In a sense, that once you start torturing someone, you've thrown in the towel. Of course, the kind of things that I'm writing about in the article, which I call coercion, are nevertheless things that a lot of people define as torture. I would argue with them that coercion is there's a qualitative difference between the tactics being employed and the sort of traditional methods of torture. But under a lot of even, you know, international agreements, what the United States is doing right now is properly identified as torture.
Put some detail on that, Mark Bowden, so we can picture it. To take us into some of the nitty-gritty of this coercion and the line you would draw between coercion and torture, what kind of techniques, what kind of circumstances are you referring to?
Well, I would classify personally torture as something that really harms an individual, whether you're cutting off a limb or scarring a person or subjecting them to intense physical pain. You know, those things are practiced by many countries around the world. In fact, those practices are cataloged by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. They're still, unfortunately, commonplace around the world. Those are things that I think are appropriately labeled torture. Coercion, on the other hand, is something that really does no permanent physical damage to the person that you're interrogating, but in all candor, is a perfectly miserable experience for anyone who's subjected to it. It means making a person terribly uncomfortable, very disoriented, it's subjecting them to drugs without their permission. All these things are, I think, by any classification or any definition, severe tactics.
Mark, get more concrete with that, because I'm not sure that it's perfectly obvious to people what you're saying. Drugs and miserably uncomfortable. How? Why? What circumstances?
Well, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, here is one of the top leaders of Al-Qaeda, someone who presumably knows who are the key people in this organization, where are the most important terrorist cells in the world, what kind of operations are being planned. If we can get at that information, we could presumably save thousands of lives. And so that man was probably brought into custody, stripped naked, wetted down, fed irregularly, placed in a small cell where he was incapable of stretching out fully, where he would basically be forced to sort of curl up in a cramped position, subjected to loud noises, light in his cell 24 hours a day, awakened roughly if he ever fell asleep, basically forced to become just a terribly uncomfortable human being.
So that's a kind of his physical circumstances, utterly miserable. What about the psychological angle? How is that pursued?
Well, I think it varies from person to person, but anybody subjected to those conditions over a long period of time begins to lose track of just sort of the basic connections that we have, all of us, to sanity and consciousness. I mean, all of us are tied to circadian rhythms and basic routines of life. And to be completely isolated from anything familiar, to be shut off from daylight, to be refused to allow any kind of, you know, normal routine to develop, and then perhaps to be injected with, without your knowledge, a drug that changes the way that you think, that changes the way you behave. I mean, basically, you become a guinea pig at that point, and you are totally vulnerable to whatever your captors or interrogator wants to do to you.
It sounds pretty awful or effective, depending how you look at it. What's actually known about how that kind of treatment is working, Mark? You write that there's actually disagreement about how much the United States has learned, that not everyone finds credible the claims that a lot of important intelligence has been drawn out of these prisoners.
It's true, and I don't, frankly, know the answer. But according to published reports, some of the top Al-Qaeda leaders who are in custody have provided very useful information to U.S. officials. In fact, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's arrest was effectuated by the arrest of Abu Zubaydah, who was captured some months before, and his arrest was set up by another al-Qaeda leader who was arrested some months before. So if you believe published reports, the kind of information that we're getting from these people is basically slowly dismantling this international organization. But as I write in the article, I think that there are some people who are skeptical of these reports and wonder if maybe it's all just disinformation, because it is hard to believe that these individuals would be cooperating to the extent that they are reportedly doing.
On the other hand, when you describe the circumstances they might be held in, that sounds pretty bad too. And enough days of that, and maybe anyone, even a lifelong, you know, acolyte of Osama bin Laden, would crack.
Well, I think that's what, you know, the article tries to explore. I tend to think that anyone subjected to the kind of interrogation sessions that these top leaders are undergoing would eventually crack and would eventually provide information. Although there are, I mean, I interviewed Michael Kubi, who is the head of Shabak, the Israeli secret service, who's interrogated many thousands of Palestinians over the years. And, you know, his experience tells him that the vast majority of people, even the high-ranking members of terrorist organizations, will cooperate. But there are occasionally, very rarely, individuals who cannot be shaken, who will not crack.
And how do these techniques line up with international agreements the U.S. is signatory to, the Geneva Convention, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Convention Against Torture? Is the U.S. within the bounds, not within the bounds?
Well, this is what's so fascinating about this, Tom. If you judge by the Geneva Convention, the United States is very definitely in violation. What we're doing to prisoners clearly violates the sort of sweeping guarantees given to all prisoners of war. But, of course, we've all seen that the Bush administration has very carefully avoided classifying the people arrested in this war as prisoners of war. They call them enemy combatants. And the reason that they're doing that is that it enables them to sort of skirt the provisions of the Geneva Convention. Beyond that, there's the UN Convention Against Torture, which the United States agreed to in the early 1990s. But again, the definition of torture in the UN agreement, in the UN Convention, uses the adjective severe. And so I suggest in this story, I think the United States is trading on the definition of torture and the definition of that word severe.
And you're right, in fact, the United States is avoiding the brand torture only by sleight of word, that is, by interpreting severe perhaps way beyond what many or most people would.
I think that's true. I think that, you know, if the Bush administration, President Bush, as recently as June of this year, issued a ringing statement endorsing the United States' commitment to the prohibition on torture, and that and claimed that the United States was adhering to all of its international agreements. Now, to square that with the reports that I'm getting, and not just me, but there have been reports in the New York Times and the Washington Post about what's happening to these prisoners, the only way that you can square those two statements is if you start to examine exactly what the words say. And I think that we're talking about a difference of opinion over the definition of the word severe.
A rhetorical commitment, but a very ambiguous circumstance on the ground. Mark Bowden, stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation Josh Rubenstein. He's Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International. He joins us from Boston. Good evening and welcome, Josh Rubenstein.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us, Josh. Josh, you've been hearing Mark Bowden fill us in tonight on what he has learned about the landscape of interrogation and coercion and maybe torture out there. Amnesty International is forever issuing reports condemning torture around the world. Is this different when terrorism is on the table or not?
Well, let me make a couple of broader political and historical points first, quickly. Let's keep in mind that in the classic episodes of torture in the 20th century, governments were not looking to establish the truth. In Stalin's Soviet Union, for example, the point was to get these defendants to agree to a lie. And through coercion and torture, they could achieve that. And in our reports about so many scores of countries around the world, the principal reason for torture is not to get the truth. The principal reason is to intimidate the population. That was true under apartheid South Africa, under Pinochet's Chile, in so many countries in Africa. It's to sustain power. It's to scare the population into silence and obedience, and has nothing to do with getting genuine, hard information in order to, say, deter a terrorist attack or dismantle an underground cells or something
like
that.
Are you saying that's the case again in this circumstance, that the U.S. isn't really interested in real information? Surely they want real information.
No, I'm saying that's in contrast. I think the U.S. genuinely is interested in information. I think Marx made a useful point that torture, classic torture, the coercive, brutal torture we're familiar with in movies and what we know goes on in so many countries, is not going to be that productive. And I think that's a very useful point. But what also needs to be said is, first, it is still prohibited. And secondly, in putting aside the moral arguments that we can go back and forth, there are pragmatic reasons why the U.S. is making trouble for itself. First, when we flout the Geneva Conventions, and everyone knows we are then engaging in torture under soldiers and enemy combatants we have taken, that makes our soldiers far more vulnerable. And even, you know, Mr. Rumsfeld was a little discomfited the last few months in Iraq when it was clear that some of the prisoners we were capturing were being mistreated. And then the few American soldiers who had been captured during the fighting this spring, they were being killed or tortured or mistreated. And it made the U.S. seem a little hypocritical for insisting that our soldiers should, of course, be treated with respect under the Geneva Conventions. But it was our prerogative when we saw fit to disregard the Geneva Conventions. I think that's a very uncomfortable position for the United States to be in.
Josh Rubenstein, hold on for a second. Mark Bowden, your thoughts on that? You've looked at this closely. Is the United States gaining enough that it's worth that risk to U.S. soldiers? Is it creating that kind of problem for itself here or not?
Oh, I think Josh is right. I think that there's a real price to be paid for going this course and for using methods that can, and you know, be broadly interpreted as torture. And I think all the more reason why the application of these methods ought to be restricted to the most to the rare circumstances where you have a captive, say a high level al-Qaeda leader like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who could I think believably possess information that could lead to thwarting attacks that might kill thousands of people. Clearly, foot soldiers arrested in Afghanistan or American foot soldiers arrested in Iraq are not going to have that kind of information, and I think that it would be really unfair to draw the comparison. But I think that if we're talking about the way that these very top-level figures are being held, there is a political price to be paid. I think Josh is exactly right. Mm. But the moral and legal argument is, you know, are we justified in these cases in applying pressure to these people?
Mark Bowden, Josh Rubenstein, stand by. Ultimately, Mark Bowden, you write the Bush administration has adopted exactly the right posture on the matter. But it's a very fine line. Listeners, is psychological coercion more acceptable than physical torture, even extreme psychological pressure? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about coercion, torture, and the dark art of interrogation, how the war on terror is being fought in U.S. holding cells around the world. My guest tonight is Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down, author of The Dark Art of Interrogation, in the October issue of The Atlantic Monthly. We're also joined tonight by Josh Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International. You can join this conversation as well. If you've been listening, what is the line between heavy interrogation and torture? Is psychological coercion more acceptable than physical torture? And does Mark Bowden have it right? And we'll hear more about this. But keep torture illegal, but practice tremendous coercion when necessary. Are you comfortable with that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul's calling from Nahant, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm not comfortable making that distinction. I think it's a distinction without a real difference.
That is between psychological and physical torture or coercion, Paul?
It's just we've adopted it because we think it's more effective. I mean, you could talk about the moral aspect of should you use it at all, but to make the distinction between the two is sophistry. It's just like the tortured distinction that the Bush administration is trying to draw between combatants and prisoners mm-hmm. of war. And let me shine a light on this by asking you, what do you think the American public, how the American public would react if they'd found in a Taliban stronghold 5.5 by 5.5 foot cells.
With naked, wet,
American,
cold, crazed
American
Americans.
Soldiers had been kept not fed, kept cold, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we had an experience like this. Nobody hesitated to call the Viet Cong's tiger cages torture.
Paul, let me ask you, I will put that to our guest, but let me ask you this. Does it make a difference in your mind that this is in the context of a threat of terrorism?
You're asking a very different question.
Well,
you're asking me, I would answer the, whatever the answer to that is, it's the same whether you use severe psychological duress or physical torture of the nail-pulling sort.
Well, strip away the veneer. Let's just call it torture. We'll call it torture.
That's right.
Now visualize those towers coming down. If you could avoid that in the future,
That's a question I'm putting to you. Why don't you pose that question to your guest?
Well, my guest is basically saying yes, but I'm just curious how you think about that.
I think under the circumstances, I probably would do that. If I knew who I was dealing with and I knew that they had a reason to believe that they had information which would save thousands of lives, then I might be tempted to do it.
But what awful moral terrain.
I wouldn't hide behind this sophistry of trying to distinguish psychological duress and all the rest from, you know, the traditional, putting prisoners on the rack, burning them at the stake, and all that other stuff.
We've got it loud and clear, Paul, and we thank you for your call. Mark Bowden, I want to be sure that this is coming across just as you intended here. Is that a distinction that you would continue to draw between physical and psychological? Is that what you're saying, that no matter how severe psychological coercion may be, it is better or less offensive than physical?
Well, I do think it is less offensive, but I agree with Paul that ultimately it's a slippery slope and there's no clear way of defining what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. But I think that the important thing, and Paul said it himself in your questioning of him, that I think that torture should be banned. It should be against the law, so that an interrogator who takes upon himself the responsibility in a particular circumstance to torture an individual, whether we define torture as coercion or pulling out someone's fingernails, has to face the consequences of doing so. And suppose you have a ticking bomb scenario where you have a prisoner who can give you information that will save thousands of lives and you torture him, then the interrogator ought to be charged with violating the law and ought to have to go to court to defend his decision to use torture under those circumstances. And frankly, Tom, there isn't a court in the world that would convict an interrogator under those circumstances.
Even if the law explicitly said under no circumstances will torture be permitted?
It wouldn't happen.
It just wouldn't happen. The court would not
pursue it.
If it had saved thousands of people from
exactly.
a terrorist
death. If the circumstances were so clearly morally correct, which they very often are, mm-hmm. and which what we face today, I think, very frequently is, first of all, there would be no prosecutor who would bring the charges, and if he did, there would be no judge or jury that would convict someone.
So there's Mark Bowden's solution. He's looked into it, and he comes out saying, ban it, make it illegal. But as I hear you, Mark, with the understanding that under certain circumstances, agents of the U.S. government may break that law, may even use torture, and would ultimately not be held to account because the circumstances would justify it. Morty's calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Hi, Morty. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think Mr. Bowden has it exactly wrong. I think that, first of all, the idea of having a public debate on the issue is critically important. And I think Alan Dershowitz covered it quite nicely in his book on terrorism.
He proposes torture warrants in there.
Exactly.
Legal torture exactly. under certain circumstances.
You do not leave it onto the shoulders of an individual to decide that he has to break the law to protect the country. You make it such that there is a fixed judicial process. And you come before a judge and you say, look, this man is a ticking bomb, and you demonstrate some proof.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a civil procedure.
And the judge says, okay, judge, I agree.
May I step in here?
Please do. Josh Rubenstein.
Yeah, well, 2 points. First, this idea that a torture warrant would resolve the issue. We have another judicial procedure that relates to the death penalty where there is no urgency whatsoever. and we know how that has been abused by the courts, by prosecutors. Do you really believe that if there were a direct threat of torture, a real urgent threat of torture, that the process of getting a torture warrant wouldn't also be abused when emotions are so high? It is not a solution. And also when Mark mentions the slippery slope doesn't only relate to the techniques you would use on a prisoner. Mm-hmm. It also relates to the circumstances under which you would use it. All governments responsible governments in quotes would say we would only use it under the most severe circumscribed circumstances. And yet we know that once it's part of the system, that people get lazy and they use it on broader and broader circles of prisoners under the circumstances they face.
Yeah,
it was true in Israel. It would be true here.
Josh, we've got that view. And Morty, we hear what you're asking. Let me go to Mark Bowden, because Mark, you've thought about this and you've directly addressed this question of whether or not, given the stakes in a world of terrorism, torture should be made legal under certain circumstances. You've concluded not. Why not?
Well, because there's an actual example of this happening. In 1987, the Israeli Supreme Court decided to do basically what Alan Dershowitz suggested, which was legalize the torture of specific prisoners under very rare circumstances, under ticking bomb type scenarios,
mm-hmm.
because the logic is just irrefutable that's morally and ought to be correct under those circumstances. And what that led to was a widespread abuse of the use of torture. Basically, every Palestinian who was arrested from 1987 until 1999, when the Israeli Supreme Court decided to step back in and ban it, everybody was tortured.
Tortured or roughed up? I mean, do you literally mean tortured?
I literally mean tortured.
Certainly
mistreated, or, you know, we're talking now, and you prefaced this whole discussion, Tom, by using the broadest definition of the word torture, and I've conceded that coercion, the sort of psychological methods,
yes.
very quickly devolves into physical methods and torture, and in fact did so in Israel.
So it's interesting. So, you're saying make it illegal, but also there's a kind of wink and nod here which says, but when you have to do it, but know that you're going to be held to account because it's illegal. You won't get off the hook unless it's clear that there was such duress.
It's the only way that I can see that you practically, in the real world, limit the use of these methods. If the individual interrogator knows that if he uses these methods, he or she is taking the responsibility on their shoulders, that they could be held accountable for it. Now, if the circumstances clearly justify the use of these methods, as I've said, there's no worry that anyone's actually going to be prosecuted or convicted. But it does prevent the use of these methods from becoming lazy and widespread.
Morty, I don't know if you agree with that entirely, but I hope it gets to your question, and we thank you for your call. Bottom line here, Josh Rubenstein, Mark Bowden has looked at this. It's not pretty, but in the circumstances of the world today, he says there are circumstances where it's necessary. You represent Amnesty International. Does Amnesty International ever agree?
No, we cannot agree to it. I'm sure Mark understands that an organization devoted to combating torture under all circumstances without reservation cannot be in the business of helping governments define when those circumstances might warrant the use of torture. We're certainly aware that governments will claim that under very severe circumstances it is unfortunately necessary, but too often they invoke it in a purely cynical way, and I'm not about to take their word for it when it would be useful or productive. I think it's best, certainly for a human rights organization, to stay out of the business of trying to guess when it would be warranted. It's our job to stand up for the principle. If governments feel, yes, they agree with the principle, but in the breach they will violate it, then I think they have to be held up to very clear scrutiny under law.
Got it. Josh Rubenstein with Amnesty International, thank you for joining us tonight. And Mark Bowden, thank you for wading in once again to a very big and very difficult arena and bringing out such a picture for us. We may not all reach the same conclusions, but we really thank you for the long look you've given us here.
Thanks, Tom. I enjoyed the conversation.
Great to have you with us. Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down and of the article in the October issue of the Atlantic Monthly, The Dark Art of Interrogation. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, North Carolina prepares for Hurricane Isabel. This is On Point. The fury of Hurricane Isabel has waned a bit during its sweep toward the Atlantic coast, but the hurricane has already come ashore at Walmart's, Home Depot's, and other stores that carry plywood, water, and foul weather supplies. Kelly Evans is the Walmart manager in Lewisburg, North Carolina. In this radio diary, she relates the gathering storm at the checkout line.
What we're seeing is a lot of concerned people not knowing if they should buy this much or if they should buy that much. You see some people who are really filling up the shopping cart, buying 6 to 10 gallons of water, where some people are being more conservative and buying 2. From the past history that we've had in the last few years in this area with hurricanes, that they're not taking a chance of not being prepared. But most of them seem to be very calm, but are taking every precaution to be prepared at this point. Every customer that comes in or every associate in the building has got some question about, you know, where is this, and are we getting more water, are we getting more batteries, and are we getting more propane? Very few of the shoppers out there do not have something in their cart that's related to the hurricane. The customer base is really looking for the gallon water, propane tank, empty gas cans, candles, batteries. Actually, what we gave out of yesterday was water, which we'll get another shipment of today, and batteries have been the two key items. In a situation like this, we would call and order a disaster relief truck from our suppliers or from our warehouse, depending on what merchandise it is that we're needing. In the front of our store, we have the pallets of water, we have pallets of batteries staged at the front of the checkout up there, and we have two associates that are helping customers find additional items that they may need. Yesterday, we had like a 40% increase over what we did in sales last year. So in this store, obviously, that caused us to have to call in people and get extra workers to come in, which has been very cooperative in this area. The people in the community have come by, and if there's anything they could do to help us get anything here. I will be staying here right in a hotel by the store so that if there are power outages or emergency situations where the community would need something for a prescription item or something, just in case the store is not open, I'd be accessible to it. But here in this area, where I want to say maybe an hour to 2 hours away to where it would hit the hardest, right now I don't see anyone leaving or evacuation. They're just being prepared for any power outages or floods that may happen. 4 years ago, I was down at the store closer to the coast where the hurricane actually hit harder. And being here at this store this far away, it's interesting to see that the same type of preparation is just as much an important issue here as it was down there. That area saw an extreme amount of flooding, and it really incapacitated people for quite some time there. Unfortunately, sometimes these circumstances, they do increase our business, but what we really try to do is to go out and do what we can to help the community. Just like when the flood came last time, on most bases we get in a truck of water and we have it on a parking lot and we pass that out free to the public and those types of things. We're really here to help the community as much as we can in a situation like this. We're just hoping that, you know, it'll pass quickly and that everything will be a lot calmer than what we would expect it to be.
Kelly Evans is store manager of Walmart in Lewisburg, North Carolina, where residents are bracing for Hurricane Isabel. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.